You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we'd be canceled if anyone listened to us. I'm your host, Justin Amozeski, and obviously I'm being facetious. You are listening to this show, and you are someone, I think. Are you someone? Ask yourself that question. And if you are someone, why don't you tell the other someones you know about this show? Tell a friend. That's the number one thing that you can do to grow this show. And I think you'll want to this trip. So this is, you know, technically the third episode of the season, but the second one in a row. So we're really getting into season nine here. And still, William is out. He's on a trip right now. So I'm going to have a co-host that I think you all are very excited about, or will be very excited about, or are very excited about. Maybe somebody already told you. Who cares about verb conjugation? Joining me this trip from America's Glove, Objectivism's second favorite, third favorite son, author, blogger, and vlogger, Don Watkins.
Hey, Justin.
Really excited to have you here, Don. It's always great. I love it. I love it for two reasons. One, you're so amazing to talk to. You always bring up stuff that I'm like, hey, yeah, that would really help the midside. And wow, this is a great conversation. But also, our audience grows the most when you are on the show.
All right.
So part of the reason I wanted to have you on is over the last year, since you appeared on the show last season, you've grown quite a bit as an influencer in sort of the, I don't know how you want to describe the sphere you're in. Maybe I'll just let you do it. To me, it's sort of like the liberty sphere, we'll say. And I just want to know sort of like what your experiences with that have been. Is there anything notable? Is there anything you didn't expect? Just what's that been like for you?
Well, I mean, the main thing that happened is that early on, I was really focused on communicating to the liberty movement more broadly and on about how to be better communicators. And then I kind of got sidetracked purposefully and deliberately, where I wanted to do stuff that was more directed to people specifically interested in Ayn Rand. And that's been really fun and really valuable. But one of the things that I'm kind of shifting towards now is going back and doing more of that kind of broader outreach. And, you know, we'll see where it leads. I like doing stuff specifically for Ayn Rand fans, but there's just so much traction you can get from speaking to a wider audience.
Do you think that's because Ayn Rand fans just aren't in the digital space?
Well, I think they are, but I think if you think about the problem that has to be solved, it's how do you get more Ayn Rand fans? And one of the things that I've come to think is that there's kind of a certain approach that, like, I try to help others take, but that I'm in a better position to take than anyone or than a handful of people. So I'm sort of interested in bridging that. Now, one thing that I am going to be trying is doing that in ways that are not primarily political. So I have a novel coming out this year, and
writes novels? Fuck those people.
Well, yeah, I somehow convinced myself it was a good idea, and 8 major revisions later, it looks like, you know, one way or another, it's coming out into the world.
No, but it's a great idea. It's a great idea. And I'll let you continue your list in a second. But I want to focus on that just for 2 seconds. One, because my joke was I wrote a novel, obviously The Cut. People can check that out at themidside.com/cut. But also, tell us a little bit about your novel. That's a great way to communicate ideas. And I think it's almost an ideal way. So what can you tell us about it?
Well, I mean, basically, I wanted to do it just to see if I could do it. And then second, like, my basic standard is I get bored really, really easily. And so I wanted to, like, basically take what I love in literature, which is, like, fast-paced, fun, funny, interesting characters, admirable characters, and depth, and kind of mix that all together in a very contemporary way. And, you know, like, art can, like, people respond to art from all sorts of different backgrounds and whatnot. And so it's much easier to break out of speaking to the same echo chamber. And yeah, I had the luxury of working with some really great editors, including people who have like no noticeable agreement with me and my ideas, but who are really excited about the book. And so I'm very curious what the reaction is going to be.
Yeah, that's actually very exciting to hear that you were able to collaborate with people who aren't necessarily going to agree with you. That's really cool, especially in today's day and age, right?
Yeah.
So is there any tease? Is there any tease about what it's about?
Well, let's put it, I'll say it combines discussions of, you know, race, feminism, stripping, drugs, and murder, sex, all into a nice package of, how would you put it, a regular college-age girl who is going to slowly transform into a Jack Reacher-type hero.
That is a hell of a tease. That is a hell of a tease. All right, any other thoughts you'd like to share? I know I kind of interrupted you a couple times there. Any other thoughts you want to return to before we head into the first segment here?
Well, I mean, I would say one thing, which is, I think you're, it, like, obviously there's a lot of Ayn Rand fans in, you know, the internet universe, but it is shocking to me that more of them, particularly the young people, are not on, like, the cutting edge of doing really interesting things, right? Like, I mean, you know, I'm nearing 40, so it's no surprise to me, like, the cutting edge is still YouTube or this, which is my, like, only exposure to Discord. But I, like, where is the meme army of really smart Ayn Rand fans? I've not seen that yet. And that is a curious phenomenon.
Well, yeah, there is actually an Objectivist Discord server out there, and some of the people in it listen to this show. And this show in particular, over the past 6 months, we've kind of connected with some of those people. So, yeah, I'm interested to see what they're doing and how they're going to continue to grow it. And then there's also people like Kirk Wilcox out there, right? He's really kind of pushing in that direction. And there's another young woman who worked for the Ayn Rand Institute. I don't know her full name, so I also don't want to give it, because I don't know if that would be doxing. I don't think she would have a problem with it, but she goes by Millennial Ayn Rand Fan on YouTube. And, you know, I don't like to use the word fair and balanced because of Fox News, but you know I'm pretty fair and balanced here in the Midside. And one of my concerns with, you know, even Kirk, right? I love Kirk. He's great. He's been on the show a bunch of times. He's hilarious. He's very thoughtful. He's very intelligent. Is just one of my greatest misgivings with the movement, and we've talked about this before, the Objectivist movement, quote unquote. It's just that I don't think these people show enough of their personalities. And that's kind of what the Midside was started as. And I hope that's what the younger people will want to do, is focus less on being like, doing what, you know, you're doing a great thing where you're going through OPAR. But we don't need everybody to do that, right? What we need is people to be like, oh, this is what it's like to live as an objectivist. And I think that's the major thing missing from the digital sphere.
Yeah, and I mean, I also have a podcast. And I mean, my podcast is more personal indulgence, so I don't expect it to ever get a big audience. It's conversations I want to have. But one of the thoughts behind it was, I'm very interested in, I've always had this idea, and I think I mentioned this when because you were on my podcast, that, like, the best advertisement for my ideas would be have, like, America come hang out with my friends and me. Like, why we're just hanging, you know, like, being normal and talking and, like, being actual people. And, like, this is the closest I can get to scaling that experience.
That I couldn't say it any better. So, you know what? Let's do that. Let's do that while we head into our first segment here, Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you would like to support the show, you can do so through two platforms, Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. I'm starting to see a shift now where for a while more people were on Patreon and fewer people were on Locals. Now it's flopping. Now There are more people on Locals and fewer people on Patreon. But whatever platform you want to support us on, we greatly appreciate how much or how little you want to give. That's themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. While I was setting up my outline this week, one of the things I said, talking to Don, because I got his input here, and I was like, hey, what do we talk about? Is I really don't want to keep giving COVID-19 updates. Like, in my ideal world, there will no longer be the weekly COVID-19 update. Because I don't want it to affect our daily lives anymore. But something happened this week that is just so absurd and so farcical that I had to bring it up. And it's... There'll be an article on the website. The article on the website is from cron.com. I believe that's a Texas site, but it's called Why Double Masking Could Be the New Normal, Houston Doctor Says. I don't want to talk about the article in specific, but just the idea that they literally came out with... The CDC literally came out this week with a study that said double masking is more effective. As, first of all, as if that's not, like, sort of more obvious, right? If you double something up, it should be, you know, speciously true that it would be better. But also, at what point does this stop? If everyone remembers at the beginning of all of this, I said that they're probably going to try and make us wear masks for life. Now they're pushing us to see if we'll wear double masks. When Don, ultimately, and this is a point that our good friend Daniel Richards said, the number one way to stop the spread, and it's 100% effective, is to stop breathing.
Oh, sorry, I was stopping breathing. I mean, did you ever see the Saturday Night Live skit where they took the idea of, you know, the Mach 3 razor, where we have three razor blades, and then there was like a competitor that came out with four, and then like on Saturday Night Live they had a commercial where like our razor has 50 blades, and it was just like this, you know, ridiculous more is better kind of thing. I was reminded of that, and now I know I'm like, I probably have a different view of you, and that I'm, if you want to put it as pro mask, that's not, I think, an exactly right way to think about it. But I think, you know, there's strong evidence this is a useful way to cut down on the thing. But like this whole two masks and all that, like there's so much security theater and so much just like signaling about tribal affiliations, right? It's I'm pro science because I wear a mask and I'm going to make everybody wear one until nobody is ever sick again. And then on the other side, you often have like, I'm pro freedom because I don't wear one and I'm not putting you in this category, but it's the people who say I should be able to walk onto somebody's private property. And if they force me to wear a mask, that's oppression. And like, to me, the biggest outrage is just that how is it possible that we had innovators create a vaccine in 2 days and a year later, like, the government can't manage to get those efficiently into people's hands so that instead of masks, what we're doing is like fully back to normal life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, because to me, it's even worse than that. And this is where, you know, the lines you're talking about between masker, anti-masker, all that comes in. They've actually said that even if you are vaccinated, you still have to be wearing masks. And that's what bothers me about the whole thing. Everything you're saying about the inefficiency, everything is well taken, right? It's been well documented about the whole, you know, you just said it. 2 days they had a vaccine and we had to wait, what, a year to start administering it? If you don't see government inefficiency there, if you don't see the evils of government being involved, I don't know what to tell you. But this whole idea that we have to keep wearing masks afterwards, that's what bothers me about the whole thing. Look, I'm not anti-masker as a concept. I agree with what you said. I agree with what you said that it is scientifically proven that it can help. But to me, they're a countermeasure for triage. They're a countermeasure for when things are extreme. What bothers me, and I get lumped into the anti-masker category, is there's no conversation about, well, what is this doing for the long term, both preventing things and for us psychologically and socially, which those two things probably overlap. The idea that we're not discussing, well, how many people are actually dying? What's the actual transmission rate? what is the trade-off with wearing masks every day for the rest of our lives? Normalizing this. And that's what's upsetting me about this, because we've normalized it so much to the point that the CDC didn't blink an eye, the government didn't blink an eye in saying, oh yeah, you have to wear two from now on.
There's definitely an undervaluing and like treating as like, I mean, basically the equivalent of a toddler whining of any desire to like go to work, spend time with friends and family, be able to see people's faces. But like my wife was even telling me yesterday, like how like she's had a job since we moved to Michigan, which was post COVID. And so like it's really hard to know what you're new colleagues think of you if you never see their faces and how they react to things. And it's a really disturbing kind of phenomenon. And yeah, you have to, individuals should be making kind of risk reward calculations, taking seriously the risk of COVID, but you can't trivialize just the value of going about your life. And I think that has been totally trivialized. And the fact that we're discussing not how do we get masks off people's faces as quickly as possible, but how do we get more masks on their faces? It's just, I mean, like, if SNL had done that at the beginning of this crisis, people would have thought, nah, that's not plausible.
Yeah, that's a lot of this crisis has been like, nah, that's not plausible, but it's reality. It's like one of my favorite jokes is that we're not living in the prime timeline anymore because of how absurd everything is becoming, how farcical. And your wife's situation, that blows my mind. I can't imagine working with people, which to me, you don't really know what they look like. It's like half a face. The number of times I've seen people and then they take off their mask and they don't look anything like I expected them to look. It's crazy to me. So I can't imagine. Like, to me, it's like, I don't know.
Do you think that there's a couple out there that's just been so fastidious that, like, they're married and it's, you know, it's like Quakers getting married 100 years ago, or it's like on their wedding night, they're finally going to demask and, like, discover what the other one looks like?
Probably. That's actually something I thought about early on, like, so you know how there's a lot of controversies about like catcalling and stuff and like approaching women in public? Like nowadays, isn't it like if you ask a woman to remove her mask to see if she's really cute or not? Like isn't that like an invasion of privacy at this point?
The TV's going to have to start pixelating the bottom part of people's demasked faces.
Exactly. It's like nudity. But don't get me started on that. Don't get me started on these fucking shows. I don't know if you've seen this. I've texted Midsider Michael about this a little bit. These fucking shows that they actually have the characters wearing masks in the show. I find that so offensive.
Yeah, I can't imagine a scenario where it's like, yeah, I want to escape into a fantasy land. If it's a show about ninjas, I'm with it. Like, go for it. But, like, you know, any other context, this is absolutely not what I'm looking for in my entertainment.
You know, if they had pitched that from the beginning, if they were like, okay, the way to beat COVID is we all become ninjas, I would have been down with that. I wouldn't be arguing with anything. I'd be like, we all get to become ninjas now? That's the cure for COVID? That'd be awesome. But instead, it's the opposite. It's dress like a ninja, but sit at home. So you're like the worst ninja ever.
Well, it's just, like when I was a little kid, I have a slightly lazy left eye and they were trying to strengthen it. And they gave me these, I had to wear a patch. And imagine going to school and wearing a patch over your eye. And you might think, oh, yeah, well, there's a way to play that off. It's like, yeah, if they had given me a cool pirate patch, like, I would have been the coolest kid, you know, in first grade. But instead, they had this, like, flesh tone sticker so that, like, what I guess it was supposed to fool people into thinking I just had my eye closed. But, like, no, make me a pirate. Make me a ninja. Like, people need to learn how to sell horrifying behaviors to people more effectively.
Yeah, and I remember Virginia Postrel tried to do that. She used to be the editor for Reason. At the beginning, she was like, oh, masks are a way of expressing individuality. And that was like her way of trying to sell masks, and I get what she was trying to do. But I didn't reply because I'm on a kick of trying not to reply to people who are wrong on the internet, because most people are wrong on the internet, and I was wasting my time. But I wanted to tell her, I wanted to say, like, isn't the ultimate individuality your face? Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to another topic that's been sort of huge for a while, and I want to get your thoughts on something about it. But first, I want to get sort of, you know, just have you give sort of the background of where you came from on this perspective. Because you took a side that I would say is very objectivist, and I don't say that in a very negative way, but it was very, that side was very unique. You and Kirk Wilcox sort of had the same sort of point of view. And it was the whole GameStop thing. The whole GameStop thing. And I generally agree with your point of view, but I just want to push it in a different direction that I don't see a lot of people taking. So the whole GameStop thing, where the shorting of the stock and everything, was basically Reddit trying to take on the hedge funds. And what I appreciated about you and Kirk and other objectivists saying what you were saying was that you were on the side opposite of Reddit. And I have a general rule in life that if I find myself agreeing with Reddit, to check my premises extra. So it's sort of like, you know, Francisco de Anconia saying, check your premises. Well, check your premises, especially if you agree with Reddit. So can you just share, before we get into like the question I have, but just share the background on why you took the side you took, what your side was, your point of view on all of that?
Well, my guess is that, like, I'll disappoint you, because I would say that ultimately I wasn't exactly taking a side, because I think that, so, I mean, just in general, I typically think that we engage in too much either-or thinking, like, why are you a Republican? It's because Democrats are evil. So why are you a Democrat? It's because Republicans are evil. And it's like, well, maybe if you just focused on thinking about what's good and judging people as individuals, you'd have a much more kind of complicated mix. And I think part of what's happened here with the Reddit GameStop thing is I think there were a lot of people on Reddit who basically looked and said, yeah, GameStop is undervalued. And it's turned out they're probably right. Like, if you look at, you know, where the stock has fallen to, it's probably in many ways closer to the legitimate value. But then there was these other elements of it. Some of them I just think were gamblers and, you know, jokers who were like, hey, I'm bored. Yeah, I'll vote on bet on GameStop. But there's definitely a nihilistic element that was trying to vilify short sellers and hedge funds more broadly. And that's what I object to, because I think, like, they are tremendous value creators. And I mean, shorts in general provide really useful information, which is most of the stock market is all oriented where everybody benefits from things going up. And you want a check on that so that it's actually oriented towards getting accurate pricing. And so that kind of vilification is what I was opposed to from Reddit.
Right, right. Well, and you just took a perspective I didn't even think, that there were some good Redditors out there. Yes, I don't mean to say all Redditors are terrible. There are rational ones. Although, if you're rational and you're on Reddit, what are you doing? What are you doing right now? Yeah. But I want to take the other side as well, where are the hedge funds always good? And what I mean by that is, and this sort of bleeds into the rest of the stuff I want to talk about in this segment, is I kind of see right now the biggest problem in our culture, in our country, being an elite class who basically gets together and uses not their talents, not their abilities, but simply their greater resources to intentionally keep everyone down in a way that is anti-reality. And my question is about this hedge fund stuff. Aren't there elements of that in here, especially when, you know, the Robinhood app decided, oh, we're going to shut these people down? That didn't seem fair to me that they were shutting them down.
Well, but what happened with Robinhood is basically, you know, so there's these clearing houses that they deal with and like and send orders to. And essentially, the more I'm going blank on the word. The choppier the waters are and the more orders that they're sending in, the more cash they have to put up. And they got to the point where they couldn't put up all the cash given all of the orders. And so, you know, it was not kind of like some conspiracy to shut out small investors. It's that Robinhood was not in a position to be able to actually execute on all the trades it was being asked to execute on. And I mean, that's what the CEO said. Unfortunately, you know, a day late and a dollar short on a Clubhouse call. But the not all hedge funds are good, but a lot of the criticisms that are directed at hedge funds I mean, it's more plausible if you're talking about, like, you know, Wall Street investment banks. But usually, like, the kind of claim that, like, hedge funds were getting bailouts and everything, like, that's not what was going on in this case. That, like, people in the finance industry help other people cover, you know, positions and provide loans and everything all the time. That's just how a finance system works, which is very different than the government coming in and saying, we're not going to allow you to go out of business, which definitely happens and which I'm really opposed to. But, like, hedge funds are, like, the least problematic, objectionable part of the finance system today, in my view.
Oh, great points. That really explained a lot, especially the Robin Hood CEO thing. I, like you said, I wish he had said that first of all. Like, people really have to, this is where your, you know, rational communication thing comes in. People really need to learn nowadays, like, to lead with the important thing, because as we've learned in COVID, where, especially, I was at the movies last night and somebody still wiped down her chair as if it hasn't been disproven that it can be transmitted via surfaces. People stick with what they first hear. So the Robinhood CEO really fucked up there. He really fucked up. If he had just said what you said a day later, first, it would have made him come off a lot better. And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I have a general view that one of the biggest failures of business is not to tell people what they do. Like, most people won't care, but the people paying attention to will. Like, I think so much of what people find objectionable about Facebook and Twitter, some of it I think is just they genuinely don't like what the companies are doing, but I think in many cases they don't understand what they're doing. And I think if companies actually explain, this is why we do what we do, this is how we make money, like, this is how we make decisions. But if you talk to, like, insiders at Facebook, there's a completely different universe of, like, why they do what they do versus what people think. And and the companies don't even try to communicate it. And so there's this gulf that I think works to their disadvantage. If Robinhood said, yeah, this is what's going on, this is why we do what we do, this is how we make money, this would have been, like, it would have not made them look so bad.
100%. And I think with social media in general, they don't have PR. These companies don't have PR. Now, there's some difficulty with that. If somebody just heard that noise, my cat walked in the room I record in a closet, and she walked across the spring doorstop, and that's why it was like, boing. So, yeah, I think that I don't know if they don't think they need PR, but also, I mean, let's do a thought experiment here. I didn't expect this episode to go here, but this is interesting. If you were running PR for Facebook and Twitter, what would you say their business is? How would you say they make money? Because I'm under the impression that they make money by selling advertising, but also by collecting our personal data and essentially using that to drive us to different places.
Well, I would say, I mean, if I was Twitter, I'd basically come out and say, we don't really make that much money, so we have to figure out a better business model. But Facebook, I mean, I would come out and say, like, we are the kind of, we've solved this really important problem, which is one of the most amazing things on earth is that businesses pay to teach you about ways that you can solve your problems. So I was actually going to write something on the whole Facebook advertising thing. And while I was writing, I said, and I was typing this out, I said, all right, let's do an experiment. I'm just going to log on and see the first Facebook ad that pops up. First Facebook ad that pops up was what was called the quiet punch. And I've been looking for, like, a way to take up home boxing. I used to do kickboxing as just a workout, and I loved it. But, like, where I live right now, I can't have a giant bag either hanging from the ceiling or the floor. And so I was like, oh, I guess I have to just, you know, wait until, like, COVID goes away and find a gym eventually. And now there's this thing that just fits right in your doorway and doesn't make a lot of noise. And I was like, all right, I bought it. In fact, it's sitting behind me right now. That's amazing that we have this tool that is basically designed to make your ad experience as enjoyable and relevant as possible, to the point that, do you know what the most saved posts are on Facebook by people?
I don't know if I want to know.
Ads. Oh. Ads are by far the most saved posts for people. And so if I was Facebook, I'd be saying, yeah, we use your information in order to give you ads that are super targeted. And one of the things this makes possible is the most amazing phenomenon, in my view, of the last 20 years, which is that the ability to start a niche business. Like, if you have 10,000 people around the globe who are interested in your weird little hobby, you can make a pretty good living in most cases. And what would have happened, you know, 20 years ago is you would have never been able to find those people. And so, you know, you'd be able to sell to the two people you happen to connect with or whatever. And the fact that now anybody can serve these niche markets, and so you can find like the weirdest stuff for your weirdest hobby that like is so fine tuned to the things you want in your life, that is so cool and amazing. And I think Facebook deserves a lot of credit for making that possible. So if I were them, I would be like going to the barricades about how awesome it is that we can turn your information into great ads.
So you just gave me an idea based upon what you were saying. If somebody had a business that simply was saying, hey, we're going to give you targeted ads so we make sure you are maximizing your time. And what I mean by that is, you know, the old school way of advertising, right, was when it was on television or radio, you would just try and find something that appealed to as many people as possible. Right? If you're paying for a Super Bowl spot, you don't want to have it targeted towards 10,000 people, as you were just saying. But instead, if you were saying, by signing up for our business, we are going to present to you targeted ads. That's what our business is, targeted ads. And all you have to do is give us access to your social media platforms. But instead, Facebook is primarily marketed as, or understood as, I don't even want to say marketed. How much marketing do they actually do? They marketed their video conferencing software a while ago, if you remember. Their webcam, that's it. They're like, here, this isn't a webcam. This is like Facebook live stream. And I'm like, it's a webcam. So they marketed that, but they don't really market their platform. But it's still, social media is seen as, it's even in the name, primarily a way of being social. But if instead it pivoted and said, no, this is primarily a way of getting you targeted advertisements, I think that would be seen as more valuable. At least I would see it as more valuable.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing because I think they internally really view themselves as, our goal is to connect people. And in fact, most of the teams, they're not measuring themselves by revenue and their impact on revenue. They're measured by, and I don't know the exact metrics, I think they probably change over time, but it's something like, meaningful engagements. And the kind of like ad space is almost, I think internally they're kind of uncomfortable with or apologetic about, and that's why it's communicated to the outside world in a really ambiguous way. And so I think it's fine to say that, like, look, our mission, the thing that we're passionate about, is connecting people. And in order to be able to do that and actually have a business that does that, we have to make money. And the way we do it is through another additional benefit. So I think, you know, if you look at the trajectory, they didn't even start advertising basically until they, you know, were quite a mature company. So it's, my basic view is just like, the more open people are, unless you're a bad guy, like, the more you can explain why you do what you do and people can understand where you're coming from. I mean, think of, like, we're both big fans of Atlas Shrugged. So much of why people sympathize with, like, the businessmen in those novels, whereas they don't in real life, is because they understand their motivations. And my view is, if you understood the motivations of most people, you'd have a better view of them, not a worse one.
Oh, 100%. I mean, if all these businessmen sold themselves the way Ayn Rand sells Hank Reardon in Atlas Shrugged, everyone would love businessmen. I mean, Hank Reardon, more than any of the other characters, I think, is the most sort of likable guy. I mean, if you were in charge of a PR firm, you would love him as a client, because it's like, here's just a guy who works hard and just sees himself as an average dude and is just trying to be happy, but all of these forces are working against him. Isn't that the typical American story? Isn't that what we love to put on television and in movies? So yeah, I agree with you there, but I think the opposite is true. And this sort of leads into all the other stuff that happened this week. We don't know where the line is between, to use another term from Atlas Shrugged, the Hank Reardons in the aristocracy of pull anymore. And that's why, you know, something you mentioned is, when we were talking, you know, d- during the week about what to talk about, and you already name dropped it on the show, you mentioned Clubhouse and the development of the Clubhouse app, the idea that we need a space where things aren't recorded because these social media companies are weaponizing the data they gather from you. They're not using it for your benefit. They're weaponizing it for the aristocracy of poll. It is a prevalent belief, and it's a legitimate question to address, to answer, to think about, is where is the line between the Hank Reardons and the aristocracy of poll? Where is the line between just the normal average businessman trying to provide a value to you and the one who is being taken advantage of and taking advantage of to participate in society to keep you down? And I think the Clubhouse story is so fascinating. And the, you know, you also shared the idea of the New York Times story where the woman was going in there, the reporter Taylor Lorenz, I believe her name was, going in there trying to find ways to cancel people. I think this is all connected. Do you see the connections I'm making?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's so interesting about Clubhouse is that, I mean, it's one of the cool, fascinating things about social media just as a phenomenon. This kind of takes me away from your point for a second, but
that's fine.
Is how so much of it seems to be like, you know, taking steps backwards, like, hey, let's reduce the number of characters you can use to communicate your ideas. And here it's like, hey, let's, you know, we have all this great video technology. No, let's just basically have a group phone call and see what happens. And yet it's in part, I think, addressing a real problem, which is that, you know, we live in a nation of hall monitors or a world of hall monitors. And here's like, let's have some cool conversations where we're not so worried about the hall monitors.
Well, yeah, with Clubhouse, though, here's a question I have for you about the way it works. I've never used it. I've never been in a stream or anything. Can you not screen record with Clubhouse? So if I
yeah,
watch a
people
YouTube
do.
Video, you're right.
Yeah.
So it's really saying, it's really just a way then of marketing to say we want people who don't want to be hall monitors together without saying that. Because you can't really stop people from recording it then.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what's going on right now is it's still kind of like in an early stage where you have like high exclusivity. And so like to some degree, you know, there's some kind of control over who shows up where. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it ultimately solves the problem. You know, it's kind of like Snapchat, right? Like, oh, cool, the messages are going to disappear. And yet you can go and just like, you know, find in the internet virtually any interesting or horrifying Snapchat that anybody ever put up.
Right, screenshotting. You know,
yeah, exactly. So, in any case,
the greater problem is the hall monitors that you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a real problem, and I mean it's super disturbing, and it's like the most interesting thing to me on Earth are interesting ideas, and when you find, and like not even just people I agree with, but people who are really thoughtful and have kind of new perspectives on things. And we kind of live in an age where there's not a concern for truth, and there's not even a concern for interesting ideas. It's all, do you obey the dogma? And then what the hall monitors are, in effect, hey, like I'm a good person because I go around trying to make sure everybody's showing fealty to the dogma, and I don't care like if they have good reasons or arguments for agreeing with the dogma. That's completely irrelevant. It's do they obey it, or do they violate it by saying, you know, no words? And you know, no words today could be completely different than what they were 2 years ago, but that doesn't matter. If you use one of them, you are, you know, if not an apostate, you know, you're a heretic, and we're going to treat you that way.
Right. And we've seen that from it used to be the OK symbol. And then they started talking about all these different dog whistles. And now there's just so many things you can't say. And that's the thing that bothers me about what you're saying. We were talking about the hall monitors and the dogma and everything. I really see this as a way of the aristocracy of poll maintaining control, where they can decide who is in charge and who isn't, and who gets to have power and who doesn't. And I think a huge example happened this past week with Gina Carano. I don't know if you saw this whole story, but she's pretty right wing in what she posts. And, you know, I don't always like what she posts. I never even followed her. But a while back, she got in trouble because the fans of Star Wars were trying to get her to put pronouns in her bio. So she put beep boop as a reference to R2-D2. For further context, Gina Carano is on The Mandalorian, or she was on The Mandalorian. She played a very popular character called Cara Dune. And she's posted very right-wing stuff since. I think she was a Trump supporter. And recently she posted an Epstein didn't kill himself meme. And at the same time she posted that, she posted things talking about... she posted an Instagram story talking about how in Nazi Germany you weren't allowed to say certain things. And then eventually that led to, you know, them going after the Jewish people. And she got fired by Disney because people were demanding that she be fired due to comparing the Holocaust to modern day conservatives. And that's exactly the hall monitors you're talking about. And this is, to me, a huge problem. This idea that we have, you know, Disney can just, and, you know, it's their platform, but what are they deciding to actually do it based on? Was that actually a terrible thing she said? You know, it's not like she was out there saying, you know, we need to kill leftists. She made a comparison, and the ultimate point of her comparison was lost. And that's a reason to fire her? It seems to me there's more going on here, and they were firing her because they didn't want somebody with that point of view to be on their show and to be part of their platform. It literally seems to me like they're trying to take away her voice.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. So first, let me say there are things that I regard as completely tasteless comparisons to Nazi Germany, where, like, if she had said what's happening to conservatives is the same as what happened to Jews, like, that would be, like, kind of boneheaded and not true. But I've never seen anything else by her, and I've never seen her on a show, so I'm not vouching for a single other thing she said. But it was, in effect, she was making the point of, this is the beginning of the process that can climax in something like that. And what I think was going on with Disney, though, is not like they want to stamp out conservatives. It's they want to stamp out bad press. And so what you have is you have some real activists who are trying to destroy anybody who violates, you know, the sacred dogma. And then what you have is you have a bunch of companies that are so timid that they refuse to stand up to that kind of bullying. And so kind of just cower in fear of these, you know, hall monitor dogmatists. And so I think it's less that Disney wants to stamp out other kinds of thought. This is my impression. I could be totally wrong, but it's much more that, we might as well throw somebody under the bus rather than, like, you know, stand up for the right of the people underneath us to advocate things that are within the bounds of legitimate opinion, which I think this particular comment by her certainly is.
I think that you've given the most benevolent possible interpretation of what Disney did, and I appreciate that because I want to live in that world, right? I want to believe that's true. So let's test this a little bit. And I'm going to push back a little bit, not because I necessarily disagree with you. I like that interpretation, and I hope it's true. But I want to make sure it's in line with reality before I completely accept it, because there are terrible things going on when you're talking about these activists, right? The kind of world they're trying to push for. You know, the social justice worldview, the Black Lives Matter worldview, the Marxist worldview, right? That exists. There are people out there trying to do that to our society, the Antifa worldview. The question becomes, at what point is Disney complicit and at what point is Disney pandering and where is the line? Because when I watch the Lion King remake and they turn it into a movie about communism, and I mean that very seriously. That's what the movie ultimately became about. And when you watch things like Frozen and Frozen 2, and they're very clearly anti-male movies, how much of that is pandering? You look at The Last Jedi, right? You can critique The Last Jedi on two levels. One, you can critique it on a level of it's just bad writing, right? The idea of, oh, we're going to build up Snoke as a character and then just randomly kill him. That's not good writing. But then you can also critique it on the level of it's a propaganda piece. It was literally just pushing the social justice narrative. You know, even the shot at the end of anyone can be a Jedi all of a sudden, anyone can be force sensitive, and we're just keeping everyone oppressed, right? At what point is Disney, as you're saying, just afraid of being bullied and afraid of them, they themselves losing their market share, losing their profits? And at what point are they complicit in knowing that this is what's going on and hopping on the train to try and be part of this power grab? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, totally. And I think that's so earlier you were raising the question of, like, you know, the pool peddlers and sort of
right.
the aristocracy of pool and this kind right. of blurring of the lines
right.
of, you know, are you a businessman who's creating value or are you one who's basically using government power in order to get unearned value? And part of my view is that one of the things that happens in a mixed economy is that that line becomes very blurred, and the person himself or herself might not even have a clear idea of, wait, am I defending myself? Am I trying to get special favors? It can be really hard to tell. And so I definitely defer to you in terms of Disney, because I'm not familiar with any of those shows or movies. I would say that one thing that would be on my mind if I were really trying to understand their actions is how much of a distinction there is between the kind of creators versus the, you know, business people who are making these kinds of hiring and firing decisions.
Oh, and I'm going to stop you right there, because that's the huge discussion this week is Jon Favreau. Do you know who that is?
Oh, I know. I know Favreau, yeah.
Right. So Favreau was the guy. He made Iron Man, right? If you look at Iron Man, Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2 are two of the most libertarian movies to come out in the last 50 years, right? Maybe that and Ghostbusters are up there as libertarian movies. And, you know, he created The Mandalorian and he, you know, this new upswing in Star Wars. But at the same time, he also did The Lion King remake, although I've heard he was so focused on the technology that he wasn't focused on the ideas in it. But there's clearly a divide here between, and we have a really easy way to concretize this, the Kathleen Kennedys of the world and the Jon Favreaus of the world. So, sorry, that was a great point you made. Continue.
Well, no, but that was basically my point. It's just that it can be really hard to assess these things. And, I mean, my basic view is just very case by case in terms of what I think is going on. And usually what I think is going on is, I don't know, like I don't have a real good take. But there are clear cut cases, right? Like, you know, we might talk about the New York Times firing one of their star reporters for referring to not calling somebody the N-word. Like the New York Times is definitely a case where they are active crusaders for an ideology. But even there, you can see a certain dynamic where it's much more the people at the top are kind of following the lead of their younger reporters and kind of bowing to that kind of pressure, even though they basically agree with them. But like, so there is a dynamic where it's the people at the top tend to hold the fundamental premises of the more radical members lower down, or the radical members in the public denouncing them. And as a result, they kind of cave. But it's not like they disagree with them, right? It's not like you have these like pro-freedom, pro-individualist people who are caving. It's, yeah, I kind of agree with you. I think you're going to extremes, but I'm not going to stand up and say that you've gone too far, and I'm going to back down. And that's often the sort of dynamic that you get.
I think you're right in general. I think Disney is a unique case, and I think my knowledge of Disney, coming from my personal experience in life, combined with what you just said, gives us a new metric I think we need to develop. And the new metric, I think, is what you just said. Is the person a crusader or not? And I think we need to figure out a better way of identifying that, because you yourself even just admitted you don't know. Now, the reason I know there's a problem with Disney, and the problem may get fixed, it may become better, but the reason I know there's a problem is the former CEO, Bob Iger, who left about a year ago. He was in office from September 30th, 2005 till February 25th, 2020. Bob Iger, he went to Ithaca College. Ithaca College is where I went. And this is where I can really identify that this guy was a problem. Because the three most leftist towns in America are Ithaca, Berkeley, and Boulder. Something I've said on this show often is one of the reasons I can identify what's going on and it's such a problem is because I lived in the belly of the beast for 4 years. I was around these people. And I took a class called Intro Mass Media, and I was in the School of Communications and around those people who were studying in the School of Communications for a long time. And in that class specifically, but in the school in general, there was this belief that corporations were using the media to push a right-wing agenda because they were businessmen. And that's what businessmen are. They're right wing. So, of course, they all own the media and it's the corporate media. So they're going to do that. Well, what do we know? SJW, social justice warriors, they always project. They were telling us what they wanted to do. So it's not a coincidence that someone like Bob Iger was in there for 15 years. And Disney has this sort of approach now that the Kathleen Kennedys are there, that they're making movies like this, that they're censoring Pirates of the Caribbean. Right. They're saying, oh, they're pirates, so they can't have a wench auction anymore because that's offensive because we look to pirates as a standard of morality and that ride was about going on there to find morality. I don't think that's a coincidence. The problem, though, in identifying these people is that took a lot of real personal experience for me to be able to identify that and make those connections. So I think what we really need is some sort of a metric to identify where the issues are and who are the crusaders and the true believers and who are not.
Yeah, I'd love that. I find it really hard, really hard to get the knowledge. And I mean, just one of the things that I've noticed is the universe that you encounter when you talk to people who are actually like in an organization is very different than the one that you encounter, you know, when you read the news or follow something in the culture. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. So I'm not saying it necessarily falls, you know, one way or the other, but it's just so hard for outsiders to really understand what's going on inside an organization.
Oh, I agree 100%. And maybe that's part of it is we need to stop this external looking in thing. And in that sense, I think one last thing I want to talk about in this segment is perhaps we can see this as giving people a tool to arm themselves. So there was a really great article, and I don't know if you read the whole thing because it was really long, but there was a really great article by a professor at Columbia. His name is John McWhorter. It was sent to me by Daniel Richards, and it's a phenomenal article, and one part of it really stood out. So this article is called The Neo-Racists, and it's all about how, you know, we've talked about this before, Don, I'm sure you've talked about this or you've read about this. It's the idea that the real racists are the people claiming everything is racist because they're the ones not treating, you know, I'll just say minorities, even though I don't like using that term in this context, just minorities as groups, not seeing them as individuals, saying it's impossible for them to succeed, right? To me, that's the real racism, and that's essentially what he's talking about. And I saw a lot. He's talking about third wave anti-racism in this article, and I saw a lot of comparisons there between third wave anti-racism and third wave feminism, where, you know, equality has been achieved, and I don't mean that in the sense of socially necessarily. I mean that in the sense of legally, it's been achieved. Now, how that is with the way individuals interact with each other, that's a different question. But it becomes a continued push about using power to make it socially equal as well. And he had a really great quote in this article that I think can be used as sort of a guiding star internal to your own organizations to ask yourself if the people you're dealing with are crusaders or cowards. And damn, I love that dichotomy I just came up with. Is this person a crusader or a coward? I think I'm going to run with that. That's awesome. So here's something you can think about. I'm just going to read the quote. Third wave anti-racism's needlepoint homily par excellence is the following. Battling power relations and their discriminatory effects must be the central focus of all human endeavor, be it intellectual, moral, civic, or artistic. Those who resist this focus or even evidence insufficient adherence to it must be sharply condemned, deprived of influence, and ostracized. So the first part. Battling power relations and their discriminatory effects must be the central focus of all human endeavor. Look for people who think that. Look for people who truly believe that and aren't just afraid of the people who are going to come after them for exerting some sort of power. Because, Dawn, to me, this perspective that this professor is identifying, these people who are trying to battle power relations and their discriminatory effects, to me, that's anti-reality. There will always be power relations. They will always have discriminatory effects. The question to me is just, what are they discriminating on? Are they discriminating on something moral, or are they discriminating on something immoral?
Yeah, I mean, I was really happy that you shared this essay with me, because it's the most thoughtful take on this issue I've seen yet, in that he is just very clear, but also, points out the insanity of this kind of approach, but not in the, you know, sort of like, you know, angry, pulling out your hair, spitting people's faces kind of way, but like, hey, we really need to understand this and figure out how we can go on with our lives without like having this kind of mentality ruin our lives. And so, yeah, I've made it put it on my to-do list to read basically everything that he's written. But the thing that really jumped out to me, I agree with everything you said, is like, I'm very interested in this idea of like what it means to respect people. And like, the conventional view has essentially become you respect people to the extent you view them as helpless victims and members of a what's a good word for it? You know, an oppressed class, right? And you're cruel to the extent that you view people as individuals who can and should take responsibility for making their way in the world. And of course, the rationalization for calling that cruel is the fact that there are injustices in the world. And yeah, they are, and they're bad, and we should fight them. But the injustices that, like, individuals who do take responsibility for their lives encounter obstacles they don't deserve. But like, what's utterly wrong is to say that it's an injustice that there are different group outcomes and anybody's ever made to feel bad, and anybody who is in an oppressed group can do whatever the hell they want and shouldn't have any expectations made of them, and that goodness consists of doing anything to cut down the powerful and prop up the powerless. That's supposed to be equated with respecting people, and I regard that as the complete opposite of respect. And so that's kind of a rambling way to say, like, I encourage everybody to read this, but I can totally see why you responded to it.
Yeah, the respect part is huge, because I always think about like the double think you have to do, the triple think you have to do when you meet someone, and I'm not saying you actually have to do this, but you would have to do this if you embrace this worldview. You would have to do to figure out how to respect someone who is in a oppressed class when you encounter them. Right? When I encounter an individual, I generally have the idea of I'm going to treat them as if they have a right to, and I'm intentionally using the third person pronoun, treat them as if they have a right to make their own decisions and that they're rational enough to make their own decisions. That's just the general way I operate in the world. And then when they interact with me, depending on the amount of benevolence they give to me, that is what emotional reaction I have to them and what practical reaction I have to them based upon the actions I take towards them, or if I speak to them, or how I speak to them. And that is how I decide how to respect a person or not, based on those metrics. But if I had to do it like, oh, here comes a black man, oh, I have to act this way towards him, here comes a black woman, I have to act X way towards her, Y way towards her, it would drive me insane. And I wouldn't, it's like you said, it would be backwards. I wouldn't actually be treating them as the individual. I wouldn't be looking at the situation I'm in and treating that person in that way. And then say it's not just like a random interaction in Walmart. Say it's someone you work with and you have to deal with them every day. You would never be getting to know them in their unique situation.
Yeah. And I mean, I just, like, if you put it in more personal terms, it's like the, you know, the people who actually, like, the way in which we actually demonstrate respect to the people we care about is, like, to tell them the truth, right? And to be honest with them. And what the, as the author calls these people, the elect, right? The people who are the hall monitors policing speech and everything. Like, what they want is that you can't tell the truth if it makes oppressed people feel bad, and you can't tell the truth if it works to the advantage of the oppressors. And so truth becomes not a value that we should cultivate, but a tool of convenience. Like, when truth works for the side of the alleged good, then it's fine, that's okay. But when it doesn't, it's out. And I think, like, if you just reflect on the last 5 years, we could definitely use, I think, a stronger dose of truth.
I think that's a light way of putting it. So hopefully we've helped people find some truth with this discussion. I think this has been a great discussion. This could obviously continue onwards, and it will continue over, you know, the rest of this podcast, however long it goes. And it continues on Don's show, so obviously check out all of his stuff. But I want to move on to a different segment now. We always try to ground what we're talking about in discussions of real life things we enjoy. So I want to move on to the art segment in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made for TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. If you want to continue the discussions we're about to have in this segment or the discussions we had in the last segment throughout the week, you can join our Discord. We record on Discord. You can listen to us while we record. That's a really cool feature of Discord. But you can also just participate in the chat. All you have to do is go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, click on any episode link, and there will be a join Discord link in there. Join there, participate in the week. I've been shown some great content recently. Somebody showed me a content, some tweets. Some content about some woman saying that the only reason you want to be healthier and work out is because you're fat phobic. It's not because working out actually helps and improves your life. And it was something, this isn't just like a random tweet this person found. This was a tweet that got a lot of attention. I wouldn't have seen that otherwise. So it gave me an opportunity to share my sort of perspectives on working out and why I work out and the value of it. So join our Discord. So in this segment, Don, I always start with, you know, a review or two, and then we watch some trailers. And when we watch the trailers, well, presumably, hopefully you already watched them. We then do, you know, we talk about hug or tackle, you know, whether we would watch the movie or we wouldn't. I believe you've participated in Trailer Takedown before. But first, I want to do a couple reviews, but I'm going to give you an option. One's a positive review and one's a negative review. Which would you like to hear first?
I'd rather end on a positive note.
Okay, so I'm going to give the negative review first. So my fiance wanted to watch the third and final movie, although I don't necessarily believe it's final because we know the way people love franchises, in the Netflix adaptation trilogy of To All the Boys. It was called To All the Boys, Always and Forever. This is, of course, the story about the Happa girl, played by Lana Condor, who is dating the white jock, and this is all about their romance, right? The first one was about it's called To All the Boys because it was the love letters to all the boys she had crushes on, and then she fell in love with Peter, who I thought he was Polish the whole time, but he's actually Russian. But anyway, in the third one, they do the typical storyline of they want to stay together past high school, but they might end up going to different colleges. Now, this entire franchise is set in California. So he gets a full ride to Stanford to play lacrosse. So she, of course, is trying to get into Stanford so they can spend 4 years together. What happens is she doesn't get into Stanford. She also applied to NYU just, you know, on a lark, and Berkeley as sort of like, oh, it's only an hour from Stanford, so I'll go there if I don't get into Stanford. Oh, sorry, I just got a text from my fiance. It's set in Oregon. Like, there's a difference. Dom, when you think of the difference in the world between Oregon and California, do you think of one?
No.
Yeah. Just Portland has more Antifa than California has, right? That's the difference between Portland and California. Yeah. Okay. So, sorry, they live in Oregon. But of course they live in Oregon, but this even makes my point even stronger, right? They live in Oregon, but he's going to go to Stanford for lacrosse, and she wants to go to Stanford or Berkeley, but she applies to NYU, you know, sort of like, oh, you know, haha, I'm going to apply to NYU because my sister told me to. Well, they take a senior class trip, and she falls in love with NYU. So, of course, she wants to go there. So what happens? Peter gets mad at her, and he breaks up with her. And then the end of the movie is he has to get back with her by apologizing to her. Because if you love someone, you should want to do anything you can to be with them. And, of course, her whole plot is the typical modern feminist thing of, oh, well, you should, no man should ever have to make you choose your career over him. Right? There is a legitimate discussion in here, Don. And this is my thing about this movie. There's a legitimate discussion, and you could have an interesting movie about what's her higher value. Is her higher value going to NYU instead of Berkeley because that's what's best for her, you know, career and her values? Or is her higher value being with this guy? But instead, they're just portrayed as in opposition. And then the choice is taken out of her hands. The choice is just, oh, she's going to go to NYU, and he has to decide if he's going to put in the effort to be with her or not. Whereas the book... Go ahead.
It's based on a book, you're saying?
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about the book. The book is set on the East Coast. It's set in Virginia. And I think he's going to UNC... No. Sorry, he's going to UVA to play lacrosse, which first of all makes more sense because East Coast lacrosse in college is phenomenal. So it makes more sense he would have gone to a UVA or a Syracuse or a Johns Hopkins. Like, those are the best lacrosse schools. And she gets into UNC, but she has to decide whether she wants to go to William & Mary, which is also in Virginia, or go to UNC. And then ultimately, she's the one who makes the decision at the end of the book to go to UNC, but to try and stay with him and make it work. So she's the main character of the novel, and it's about her making the decision. Whereas in the movie, she's the main character of the movie, but it's about him making the decision and him overcoming his. They added a whole subplot about his dad abandoning him, so he didn't want to be abandoned, so that's why he broke up with her. And even though she's not choosing him by going across the country, he had to accept that she wasn't choosing him and still decide to be with her. So just the way this all was framed, just it really bothered me. It could have been framed much better, but it's very obvious to me, a crusader, as I said earlier, you know, crusader or coward, a crusader took this franchise, this book franchise, which did things in a more interesting way. Right, talked about the, you know, again, I haven't read the book. I only know what the book's about. But it seems to me the book is more focused on the protagonist and the decisions she's making. And they made it more about the world acting on her and making it harder for her to have everything she wants.
It's always dangerous to ascribe things to bad writing instead of like assuming that the writer knows what they're doing and is trying to say something. And who knows about the translation from book to movie, but to me as a writer, this sounds like people desperately in search for stakes. So I watched Bridgerton recently, and it's a mixed bag, but overall really good. But one of the things you can do that is very hard in the modern era is have stakes with relationships, right? And have real obstacles. But like, if you really think, I'm trying to write a book and it's, oh, like, we can't go to college near each other. Like, that is not the hardest problem on earth to deal with. Like, people do it all the time. And it, you know, it would be, oh, like, yeah, obviously you have priorities too, not just to be at my beck and call. Like, I don't know. It, to me, it just sounds like, all right, we're trying. We know we have to have stakes. How can we make some? It should be a travesty and a tragedy if they go to like far apart schools.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, I agree that
it's just hard for me to care.
Right. And you know, it smacks of first world problems, right? Especially in the movie, like. This is supposed to be like an era where we're aware of things like privilege, and then you make a highly successful movie on Netflix where they take a class trip from Oregon to New York City. Like, what the fuck kind of a school do you go to? That's your senior class trip, right? So I agree with what you're saying, and surely probably in the book they were searching for a way to have a third book, right? Because it's the third one, keep the franchise going because it was selling so well. But my problem comes in with the translation from the book to the movie. I agree with what you're saying. The base premise of, like, this is not, like, a huge, huge conflict, huge issue is true. But you already have it in there. Why change it to the West Coast? Why change it to all of these things? Unless you're so obsessed with your own lifestyle. The whole idea of Stanford or Berkeley rather than UVA or UNC. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I would be I am always fascinated and baffled by like changes Hollywood makes that you go like, why? Like, presumably when you have a book, right, you have something that works, and sometimes changes are necessary because like books you can really have internal conflicts drive a story, whereas you need to externalize it for movies. But so often it's things that just have. Like, they seem really arbitrary and just make things really worse. And now I'm almost fascinated to read the books and watch them just so I can try to unravel this for a future show.
See, now you're like me, where, like, I read all of The Walking Dead that I could and watched it because I loved just seeing the way it was translated. Right? I tried to do the same thing with Game of Thrones, but I didn't love either of them enough to do that. But I'm fascinated just on that level of the translation between the two. All right, so the positive review. This is going to be a lot quicker because all I want to do is say, see this movie. The Marksman, starring Liam Neeson. This is about Liam Neeson being a veteran of the Vietnam War who served in the Marines. He owns a ranch in Arizona. His wife recently died, and the medical bills wiped him out. And his ranch is going up for auction because he can't afford to pay his loan. The ranch is situated on the Mexican border, and he has a relationship with the border patrol because his deceased wife's daughter works in the border patrol. I don't know why they didn't just make it his daughter. Maybe this is based on a book too. I don't know. But it was very strange they didn't do that. But anyway, he has a relationship where often he'll catch people coming across the border, and he won't do anything, but he'll call in the border patrol and say, hey, here are these people. Well, he encounters an extreme situation where a woman is bringing her son across because her brother stole from the cartel, and the cartel is chasing them. Well, there's a battle with the cartel, and Liam Neeson kills one of them, but they kill the mother. And the mother says, please bring my son to my relatives in Chicago. So the rest of the movie is Liam Neeson trying to figure out, should he help this kid or not? Is it a value to him to help this kid or not? And I went into this movie expecting it to be the typical Liam Neeson action movie. But it actually ended up being very dramatic and very emotional. And I thought the second half was much better. Maybe it's just because they got me invested in it and it went from the cheesy action movie to that. But it was much less action oriented and much more drama oriented. And I thought it was very well done. I thought it showed sort of the gray area, right? You were talking earlier, Don, about either or. Right, it wasn't either or with all of the characters, especially even Liam Neeson himself, even the young boy. It wasn't either or. It was showing all the difficulties of their situations and the difficulty of this decision, and it was dealing with people as individuals. And I just thought it's really worth seeing. I'm not saying it's the best movie ever, but I was moved to tears twice during this movie. and I'm not afraid to say that. And I think that speaks to it. So I think the movie is worth seeing. My sort of one negative is I think that the way they handled the villain, the bad guy, trying to make him either or, I think it was a bit too expository in the way they executed it. I think they told more than they showed, but that's sort of like a minor critique of it. So I would check out The Marksman starring Liam Neeson.
I really love it. So much of my interest in art and entertainment is just the search for stuff that's like interesting, where it's, yeah, I don't know what kind of story this is, right? Like, this is not like, I mean, I love, you know, an old style Liam Neeson, like I'm going to destroy, you know, a kidnapper, like that's fine. But I love things where you're just trying to think like, man, where is this going? What kind of movie, what kind of TV show is this? And that sounds really intriguing to me.
Yeah, it's sort of like Gran Torino meets Logan with a little bit of Taken in there. So if you like any of those movies, you would definitely enjoy this one. So those are movies that are already out. Let's talk about some movies that are going to come out in Trailer Takedown. Trailer Takedown, I always post the preview on Saturdays. So you can go there, you can watch all the trailers beforehand, you can watch them afterhand, or you can alternate. You watch a trailer, we talk about it. You watch a trailer, we talk about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Godzilla vs. Kong is the latest entry in WB's MonsterVerse. Right? They did the King Kong movie, Skull Island. They did the Godzilla movie. Godzilla, King of the Monsters or something like that? I don't know. This is their face-off movie. This is a movie that Warner Brothers, like Wonder Woman 84, is doing their simultaneous release. They also did it with The Little Things, starring Jared Leto. Can't remember who else was in that movie. That's how not good that movie was. Their simultaneous release on streaming, HBO Max, and in theaters. So that actually makes, you know, the hugger tackle here a little bit more interesting for me. This trailer doesn't have much in it. They try and establish Kong as a good guy because he made a pledge to protect a little girl. I don't know why. Then Godzilla shows up and somebody's like, there was a war and they're the last two survivors. I mean, I guess kind of figuring out the war between kaijus would be cool. Isn't that kind of Pacific Rim? Pacific Rim kind of touched on this too. I don't know. This doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't. I don't see what themes can be concretized here. I don't see what ideas can be concretized here. But visually, it looks cool. And if I got nothing else to do, I'll watch it on HBO Max. So this would be like a tentative hug. Or rather, no. Sorry, I'm gonna take that back. Tentative tackle. Sorry, my bad. Good thing I'm the one doing the drops and posts this week.
Tackle.
Well, my confession is that I just zoned and forgot to watch these. But this one, I can take a very strong position on just based on I do not like spectacle movies. Therefore, hard tackle.
Tackle. Second trailer.
The Mighty Ducks, and I don't even remember the name of the series, but there's a trailer out there for the Mighty Ducks sequel series. On Dawn, I really wish you had seen this one because this really goes to the point of, you know, Crusader versus Coward. Let me get your opinion on this so we can just have a discussion about this one very quickly. The point of this trailer is that the Mighty Ducks have become like an unstoppable franchise. And it's no longer about just having fun and letting kids play. So this other kid has to start his own team so kids can just play. And, of course, they bring back Emilio Estevez. But to me, this isn't the most interesting way of continuing the Mighty Ducks franchise. And it says a lot about our society that they're essentially making the Mighty Ducks the villains. Couldn't you have done something internal to the Mighty Ducks where, oh, they started losing because they lost their way of not enjoying it anymore and not being about making the kids better? And that the franchise started falling apart, so it had to be redeemed from within by someone helping fix their value system? But instead, we make them the villains?
Ugh, tackle.
I mean, it feels to me almost like they're trying to do, you know, something like what they did with Cobra Kai and Karate Kid, right? But I think it's completely ham-fisted. It's instead of we really have something new and unexpected to say, it's, hey, how do we revive this franchise? Which is a shame because I think Mighty Ducks 1 and 2 are amazing films.
3 is like, underrated. Particularly, you need to go watch it again.
No, 3 is good, but like, I mean, number 2 I regard as like one of the best kids sports movies ever, and maybe it would even be on like my top 10 sports movies. But like, this just smacks of we have nothing to say. Like, I just feel like if I sat down for 15 minutes I could come up with a better premise.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, imagine, for instance, like, even just, hey, guess what? Our society now, like, no longer wants kids doing dangerous sports. Or, hey, nobody likes hockey in America, and all of our kids who are superstars grew up to be broke and poor. And, like, there's just so many directions that you could take it that would be so much more interesting and raise real questions than, hey, guess what? Greed is bad. Tackle.
Don didn't even watch these trailers and he's nailing it. This next one, though, it's easy to nail. Cosmic Sin is a sci-fi action movie starring Bruce Willis. And do you really need anything else? No. So this trailer reminded me of sort of like Battlestar Galactica meets The Expanse, which, again, if I tell you Bruce Willis is in a movie that's sort of like Battlestar Galactica and The Expanse, would you not want to see it? I don't have anything else to say about this trailer. Hug.
I'm so torn. Because on the one hand, I don't really like sci-fi. But on the other hand, I will watch Bruce Willis in everything. So I guess I have to say hug.
That's the right answer. 3 for 3, Don. I like it.
Final trailer.
Happily is a movie that this trailer is crazy. And that's part of why I put it on here. So I actually had like a different 4 trailers. And then I swapped one out for Happily because I watched this movie. It stars Joel McHale and I don't know who plays his wife. But they're happily married and everyone hates them for it. And acts like they're the abnormal ones. And then actually Steven Root shows up as like a government official and is like, you can't be this happily married. It's not normal. So we have to inject you with these chemicals in order to make you more normal. And to me, just even that right there, that setup is just like, wow, that's a stark commentary on our society. But then this movie seems to become a horror comedy because it looks like the wife kills Steven Root. And then I don't even know what happens in the rest of this. I can't remember. But just that setup in a horror comedy. My fiance just texted me, sounds like a society towards Giselle and Tom Brady. Yeah, that's the entire point. That's why this premise is so exciting for me. So I love the premise. I love that it's horror comedy. This hits right in the Justin sweet spot. This is a massive hug for me.
Hug.
I'm intrigued. Hug.
Hug.
All right, so that brings us to the end of this trip into the midside. Don, what did you learn?
The main thing I learned is that I need to follow my high school teacher's advice and read all the instructions before I take my test so that I do not fail to have fascinating things to say on Trailer Takedown.
That's all right, though, because you said all the right answers. So I have no problem with you agreeing with me 100% by not doing your homework.
But I have no clue how biased your presentation was. Like, you know, that, what if it's not actually Bruce Willis at all?
Oh, well, it was Bruce Willis, but you know my presentation was 100% biased. So, all right, what I learned is I think I learned something very important. I think we learned we need a metric for judging who is really a crusader and who is a coward. I think that's one of the most important things we need to arm ourselves with going forward into the year 2021. So that's something we're going to be looking at here in the midside going forward this season. Crusader or coward, and how do we figure that out? All right, Don, I want to thank you for joining the show. Here's your opportunity. Plug to your heart's content. Say anything and everything you want about how people can reach you and support you.
Best way, go to donswriting.com and sign up for the newsletter, and you'll learn about everything else. But I mean, the main way that I put out content is on my YouTube channel, but the newsletter is way more important because that's how you will hear about my novel. And by buying your novel, you will allow me to escape from reality and just have a career as a hermit who writes fiction that is completely out of touch with the real world.
Isn't that what we want everyone to be? Wait, no, what am I talking about? I don't want you to be a hermit because I really appreciate you listening to this show. Thank you, as always. You're what makes this show worthwhile. Otherwise, it would just be me screaming into a microphone. And that's kind of what the solo episodes sound like, but I appreciate it. Thank you. As always, thanks to our Liberty.me listeners. You know, we love our libertarians. You know I walk that line because I know some objectivists say, Ayn Rand hated libertarians. I don't have a problem with most libertarians. So thank you. Appreciate it. As always, if you want to pick up a t-shirt or anything, like a Hail Snydra t-shirt, I should probably mention the reason we didn't talk about the release, the Snyder Cut trailer, or the Zack Snyder Justice League trailer, is it was released as we were recording this episode. So it's been very hard for me to focus right now. I'm just like, do I push through this episode? No, that's why we didn't talk about it. But you can buy your Hail Snyder t-shirt on themidside.com/store. As I said at the top, you can support us on Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode, Locals is per month. themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/Locals. And as always, the number one way you can help support this show is to tell a friend. That's how we find more Midsiders. That's how we make it better, how we make it easier for us to be able to witness the farce and distinguish between who is a crusader and who is a coward. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wozneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce. Don, deviating from the format. All right.